Let me see how I run that on.
Special edition of Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On today's program, our guest is Michael Franti, lead singer of Spearhead.
Rock, rock, y'all. Spearheads comes alive on the eve of 2000. 1145, no job. We be surviving, singing praises to God. Every time we throw that, and every time we puff live.
Michael Franti, formerly of the Beatniks and the disposable heroes of hip-hopracy, is now the lead singer and group leader for the band Spearhead. Franti is one of the leading voices in the conscious hip-hop music genre and in political music as a whole. We spoke with Michael Franti prior to the December 1st show at the Northern California Center for the Arts in Grass Valley, California.
I was born in Oakland, California in 1966. My father is black, my mother is white. When I was born, I was given up for adoption. And so I was raised in a family who had white parents and some white kids then, and it was also, they also adopted another black son into the family. And I never really fit in with my family, and never really fit in with the community I was raised in. And was very rebellious teenager. And so from that, you know, I remember one situation when I was a kid that really still sticks out to me to this day, which is I was coming home from kindergarten, and there was these kids who were on the opposite side of the street, two white kids, and they started calling me a nigger, you know. And I went home and I felt really hurt, and so I went to my parents and I was crying. They said, "What's wrong?" So I said, "Oh, some kids were calling me bad names." And they said, "What was it? Did they use the F word? Did they use this word? Did they use that word?" And I was really scared to even say anything because of my family. Cursing was not allowed at all, and very strict. And so I told them it was the N word. They didn't explain to me that it had a racial connotation. They just told me, you know, sticks and stones will break your bones and names will never harm you. And as I went through life, I've been hit by some sticks and some stones, and I've been handcuffed, and I've had pepper spray in my eyes, and I've been shot out with rubber bullets. And those things always healed. But I found that words were the things that scarred me. And the names that people said to me, and the times when people said, "You can't do this because you are this way or this persuasion," or of the discouraging things that people have said to me in my life, have been the things that really still hurt me to this day as an adult, and are the things that I still deal with in my growth and meditation. And so I found that the best way to heal is to give voice to emotion. You know, and when I give voice to the deep sadness and pain and sorrow that I've had in my life, it's like a wave. It comes crashing, and I cry, and I scream, and I shout, and I punch my pillow, and then just like a wave, it subsides. And so that's where I've come from, and I guess that's why I've always had this love for the underdog. And I've always felt like I wanted to speak out on behalf of people who weren't having their voice heard and weren't having their their words heard, and hopefully through my saying the words and the music, that it helps other people to find a voice for those emotions that don't get to come out.
Why do you think America has such a difficult time in dealing with its race problems?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, America was founded on racism. It was founded on genocide of Native people, on the enslavement of African people, on the premise that women are intellectually inferior to men, that it was founded on very conservative, fundamental Christian values about sex and sex roles and sexuality, and that white people who were poor and who didn't own land were not allowed to participate. And so gradually along the way, each one of those things have been fights. You know, it's been difficult for those people who have been in control to give up little bits of power along the way. And then this whole system was set up of a consumer society, you know, where we don't just all grow our own food and go on about our business. We try to earn as much money as we can, and then we're based on what we're able to spend. That's how we're judged. And so there's this myth that anybody can succeed and that anybody can become one of those people who has a lot to spend, and that by doing that you become whole and accepted in this culture. And so people haven't wanted to look at race and how people are divided, and there's this myth that anyone can succeed, and you know, it's just not true, you know. And a lot of times other things get blamed for it. You know, for example, right now there's a lot of controversy about Eminem, this white rapper who's supposed to be doing this, you know, black art form, supposedly, you know. And, you know, he's now putting out these messages to white kids in the suburbs about, you know, that are bad messages and misogynistic and homophobic and things that now white America doesn't want their tender little children ears to be hearing. And you know, the thing is, it's that the record industry sets up the most divided racially sort of thing that you could ever imagine. You know, there's music that is, they just call it straight up, this is the black music department, you know, and here's basically the white music department. And radio stations, some of them play black music and some of them play white music. And this art form, which is supposed to be the most, you know, unifying, is, in from a business sense, super divided, you know. And so we bring kids up with that. We bring kids up with the notion that there's black kids listen to this music, and white kids listen to this music, and there's other things black kids do culturally and other things white kids do. And when you try to cross those boundaries like Eminem, you start catching flack for it. And rather than parents saying, like, let's go into the house and let's sit down and listen to this Eminem record together, and if you're really against the violence and the homophobia and the sexism in it, let's talk about violence and homophobia and sexism, they say, oh, I just don't want you to hear it. And so what that teaches them is not that, you know, violence, homophobia, and sexism are bad. It teaches them that daddy is a fascist, and if I want to hear this, I'm going to have to sneak it into the house.
My name's Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse, and our guest is Michael Frank of Spearhead.
Digging deep, I scream, oh no, there's nothing in the pocket but a great big hole. While I was busy thinking if he would buy smack, the jingle in my pocket slipped through the cracks. No one has a change and it's messing up my head, but now I know the reason why I had to buy the thing.
I'd really like to talk to you about this upcoming album that you have coming out, because when you were describing it before, I found the concept to be tremendously interesting. I think our listeners would too. Can you talk about that?
Well, I've been really inspired by micro radio and by community radio in general ever since the KPFA whole fiasco went down a year and a half ago, where the Pacific Foundation decided to shut out all of the people from the community who were running and programming the station. And it took the entire community's effort to bring back KPFA. And it's kind of like you always, and every time I go to, I always flip to the left and sort of twiddle it around a little. And I know I'm going to hear some jazz or some type of ethnic music or some news that's interesting to me from the community. And when KPFA was about to go under, it suddenly dawned on me that, you know, we really take it for granted that we have that part of the radio spectrum in this country, and that it could very easily go away. And so I decided I wanted to make a record that was about a micro radio station. And so it woven in between the songs on the album, there's a call-in show, and there's a couple DJs. I'm one of them, and this woman named Nazila is another DJ. And we take callers who are discussing this death penalty case. And there's a governor who's played by Woody Harrelson, who's trying to execute this woman right before the election, because he feels if he does that it's going to get the public support behind him, you know. And Kilo Inyasha plays that woman. And I don't want to give away too much of the story, but he does, he ends up executing her. And then the day after the election, he wins the election. The next day they find out that the real murderer comes forward and confesses to the crime.
I mean, that's I'm sitting here with him. Not only is that an artistic concept, but a tremendously emotional one, and tied to so much of the really mean-spirited politics, I think, that we're seeing in this country.
Yeah, definitely. You know, you hear all these things of, you know, stop the war, you know, stop the drugs and let's fight crime. And you hear politicians who for the last 20 years have made their living off of these types of slogans. And what it's left us with now is a country that went from having 300,000 people behind bars in 1979 to a country that has over 2 million people behind bars. And I saw one of the most compelling interviews I've ever seen about prisons was done with former televangelist preacher Jim Baker, who did time. And he said he's a very outspoken prison reformist now. He said the most startling thing you'll find about prison is it's not gangsters, murderers, and thugs and hard-ass people. It's plumber that you see next door, it's janitors, it's business people, it's just everyday people from everyday walks of life who are now locked up behind bars because of this war on drugs and the fact that we have 70% of our prison population in for petty drug offenses. And so I wanted to highlight all these issues on the record. It's not just a record about the death penalty or about micro radio. All the songs on it are uplifting songs about keeping our faith and keeping our hope and dream and vision alive during this time when, like you said, there have been so many politicians who have this mean-spirited, you know, political drive.
Michael Franti and Spearhead here at the Democratic National Convention. The scene is becoming very, very, very cool with the helicopters flying low. Now there are two, and trying to be even more provocative. Skylights are searching the sky. The helicopters are making their way around with their searchlights. The Staples Center is lit up in red and purple. The lights across downtown Los Angeles are becoming more visible. On the Hotel Figueroa, giant portraits of Cesar Chavez, Franklin Roosevelt, Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, and Eleanor Roosevelt look out across the crowd.
Time, a painful time, a time where cynicism rots the vine, and a time never search for cash. Everybody wanna be some fat tycoon. Everybody wanna be on a tropic honeymoon. Nobody wanna sing a little bit out of tune or be the backbone of a rebel platoon. It's too soon to step out of line. You might get laughed at, you might get fined, but do you feel me when I say I feel pain every day when I see the way my friends gotta slay? They never get ahead of bills they gotta pay. No way, no way. So make a living doing killing, Colombian penicillin. Some are willing to play the villain, they just chilling. To pass the time, pass the information, or pass the wine. Pass the buck, or pass the baton. But you can't pass the police or the Pentagon. The IRS or the Black China. It's time to make a move out of your
going to be coming out, and one of the songs that is going to be on that is Rock the Nation. I heard you perform that at the Democratic National Convention out across from the Staples Center. You're an artist who's brought his talent into the political realm quite often. Can you talk about that?
When I first started writing songs, my first songs were about the situation that was taking place with the apartheid system in South Africa. I was writing poems about that because I was in college and our school was, there was a movement on campus of students who were trying to get the school to divest from South Africa. And from that, I started to write songs and put them to music. And the main message in my music has always been about compassion. And it's my goal to try to enrage, enlighten, and inspire people to become more involved in the world around them. And So sometimes that takes me into, you know, political situations, protests directly, and other times it's just, you know, it takes me into just meeting with kids at a junior high or even in elementary school and talking to them about the world and my experiences as a young person growing up in this country. So that part of what I do, I find to be very rewarding, in that it's really a challenge sometimes to get ideas across. I heard this great quote from Desmond Tutu. He said, "The most difficult thing is to try to wake up people who are only pretending to be asleep." And I feel like a lot of times that's what's going on in this country. There's a lot of people who kind of know what's going on, but are really trying their best to just look the other way and say, you know what? I really don't have time to deal with this, and it's too much out there to take on all at once. And that's where I see that music really fits in, is that music has that power to energize people and to have people look around them and say, you know, I'm not the only person in the world who feels the way I do about these things, and that it's okay that I'm pissed off about what's happening, and it's okay that, you know, I'm mad that the school doesn't have toilet paper, you know, and it's okay that those, you know, all the toilet paper is now in the prison that he used to, you know, be where the school is, you know. And so that's what I see as the role of music, is to try to inspire people.
My name is Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse, and our guest is Michael Franti of Spearhead.
Staring in my eyes just as I'm walking past, I'm trying to avoid him cause I know he's gonna ask me about the coinage that is in my pocket, but I don't know if I should put it in his pocket. I walk right past to think about it more. Back at the crib, I'm opening up the door. A pocket full of change don't mean a lot to me. My cup is half full, but his is empty. I put back on my cap and I start
talking about the music industry. Artists such as yourself, who are political and who have been known to castigate corporate control of the United States. What kind of price does an artist who is willing to take those risks in the music business, what kind of prices do you face?
Well, you know, I've been in other countries. I've been to Cuba, and I've been to, different places, especially in Eastern Europe before the wall came down. I did a tour of East Germany with some two Russian bands. Definitely the prices that we face as political artists in this country are not as severe as other artists around the world who lose their lives or who lose the opportunity to play music or who are locked up for long periods of time. But I think that what we're up against here is this conspiracy of silence, that our music is not going to be our life threatened for. It's just that you're not going to get played on any radio station that's a commercial station, you know, because you're not going along with the values of this commercial entity. And there was a long time when it was really difficult to make independent music. But today, because the means of production have dropped so drastically in price that, you know, for a few thousand dollars, you can set up your own home recording studio and basically produce an album quality recording. Whereas in the past, you had to go to a really expensive studio to do that. And now everybody can, you know, with a few $1,000, you can go and buy some CDs. You can start selling them out of the back of your car or at your own shows or whatever. It's possible now for a band to really make it without the aid of a huge corporation. And if you look at bands like String Cheese Incident, for example, or a lot of the other jam bands who have become really, really successful without the help of airplay or of record company promotion. And then on the same thing on the hip hop side, with a lot of underground street level hip hop that gets out there and can sell millions of units without any airplay and really from the independent labels. The times have changed. But still, for political music, it's there's a conspiracy of silence.
Why he's back on the clip microscope with the number one hit. The posse and the ease in my juggling idea.
When you look at your career up to this point, what are pieces that you've done that you feel are the most important or the most you're the most proud of?
Well, the song Positive is a song that really changed the way that I write songs. Because like I was describing, when I first wrote songs, they were very, very political rants against the system, you know. And when I was in Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy, apart from a few songs like Music and Politics, I was still, you know, to borrow a phrase from my buddy Zach, raging against the machine, you know. And then I wanted to write a song about AIDS. And what happened was, I started to really think about how AIDS has gone from this disease where a friend of a friend of a friend had it to a friend of a friend, and then pretty soon my friends had it, you know, and people that I knew and were working around were contracting the virus. And so at first I thought, man, I want to write a song that says F the system because they're not responding to this crisis and I'm really pissed off. And then I realized that that wasn't what AIDS was about for me. And that wasn't what AIDS was about for the people who were infected, for the people who were working at clinics, and for the people who were going in to get tested. And so I went and I had a test myself, and I waited for the time for the results to come back. And during that time, I asked myself, God, you know, how am I going to live my life if this test comes back positive? How is that going to change? And how am I going to talk to my lover about that? And how am I going to talk to my mother about that? And how long do I have to live? And wow, I was really, you know, scared. So I put all that emotion into the song Positive. And that became a big change for the way that I wrote songs. And I didn't write an aggressive song that was just like wanting to bang ahead. I wanted to make a melody that people could listen to repeatedly and so that they could really get to know the words and understand the emotion of the song. And so I think that's probably was a key, really key point in my career as far as writing songs. And I've just still kept growing from that point and tried to say, hey, rather than just writing songs that are about, you know, one emotion of anger, let's write songs that are about all the emotions of life. Because, you know, like I was saying before, you don't have toilet paper in the school, you're really pissed off, you know, but yeah, you still got to take a dump, you know. You know, and you feel kind of bummed out and your toilet might not be clean in my house, and it might, you know, might be a good thing to like just, you know, put some nice music on and clean the toilet. Sometimes there's different emotions, and while you're cleaning the toilet, you're thinking about, God, I really got this other thing on my mind. And that's how music operates for me in my life. It's like I get up in the morning and I might listen to Bob Marley to Rise and Shine, and then I listen to some hip hop during the afternoon. Be stuck in traffic somewhere, so I might want to put on some more mellow music just to cool out. Then I come home and listen to some, you know, jazz at dinner time, and then, you know, listen to Sade or Barry White when I want to make love, you know. And I think if music affects my life that much from minute to minute, imagine how much music affects the whole 7 or 6 billion people that there are on the planet.
Make sure we are protected. I walk through the park just like a question mark heart.
high greenery made me feel kind of dreamery, thinking how I used to be. Arrive at the clinic and walk through the front door. I take a nervous number, then I'm thinking some more about all the times that I neglected, making sure that I was protected. They took my blood with an anonymous number. 2 weeks waiting, wondering, should have done this a long time ago. A lot of excuses why I couldn't go. I know these things and these things I must know, but it's better to know than to not know. But how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? Is it gonna be a negative? Or how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? But how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? Is it gonna be a negative? But how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? I try to give myself a risk assessment. The waiting is what can really annoy you. Every single day is more paranoia. I'm reading about how it gets transmitted. Some behavior, I must admit it. Well, who I slept with and who they slept with. Who they slept with. I think about life and immortality. What's the first thing I do if I'm HIV? I have a cry and tell my mother. Get on the phone, call my past lovers. I never thought about infecting another. The times that I said, don't bother. Was it really all that magic? The times I didn't use a pole for lack. Will my whole life have to change? Will my whole life remain the same? Sometimes it makes me want to shout. All these things too hard to think about. A day to laugh, a day to cry. A day to live and a day to die. Till I find out, I may wonder. But I'm not gonna live my life 6 feet under. Cause how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? Is it gonna be a negative? But how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? But how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? Is it gonna be a negative? But how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive?
My name's Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse, and our guest is Michael Franti of Spearhead.
When I think anyone listens to your music, they experience through it the fact that you have a vision. What is that vision?
It's a really good thing that to think about vision, because when I was out at the different protests over the last year at the WTO in Seattle and the both Democratic and Republican convention, I saw different people approaching their protests from different perspectives. And some people were there, peaceful protesters carrying signs, there with their families. Other people were there in direct antagonism with police and throwing bottles at police and breaking windows and stuff. And I started to ask myself, well, wow, what is the right way to do what we're doing here? And as I was asking myself, what's the right way to do what we're doing? I said, well, what is it exactly that we're doing? And I had to stop and really think and say, well, you know, man, there's all these different people here from all these different organizations who are all sort of believing in, you know, kind of, I guess, progressive principles, but what is the final outcome that we're trying to achieve? And for me, what I see it as is that there was a time when we had, you know, black rights and women's rights and gay and lesbian rights and environmental justice. And now it's a time that we have to move to beyond just just those individual things and say, what does social justice mean across the board and all aspects of our lives? Because really, you go to a protest and at the end of the day, something might not really change instantaneously as a result of that big action. But certainly recycling your bottles at home is a big significant change, you know, and using less power is a different, is a big change, and getting to know your neighbors is a big change, and raising your kids in the way that you want the world to be is a big change. And each of us bring into a protest what it is that we're dealing with in our lives. And some people are really frustrated about their family or about their just disenfranchisement from the system. And they feel like, man, I want to just throw a bottle at a cop because that's what I see now. But really, is that getting us any closer to what I see needs to happen in order for things to change, which is the creation of consensus? You have to have a certain amount of people, you know, 10 or 20% of the population says, we're going to start to change. We're kind of leaning in one direction. And then the rest of the people sort of tend to follow along with this momentum, you know. So in order to build consensus, are we doing that when we throw bottles at cops? You know, is that really bringing people into our team? You know, and or is peaceful protest doing that and bringing people into our team for that matter? And I don't have the answer all the time. You know, I know certainly that if you're going to engage in an armed struggle, you know, which, you know, I'm pretty much I'm a peaceful person. I believe in exhausting all peaceful means before you do any type of armed struggle. But I also understand that people like the Zapatistas or other, you know, revolutionary movements, that as a matter of self-defense, they've had to arm themselves. So if you are going to arm yourself, then you have to train and be prepared to die for what it is you believe in. Going out and throwing bottles at a cop is not doing that. If you're going to go up against the cops, then you should train and arm yourself and be prepared to do it and understand why you're doing it. I don't think we're there in this country, and there's not really a need for that in this country. So therefore, we have to look to peace. And peace is the way that we are going to build consensus. You know, there was a story someone told me about Gandhi, and he went before the head big court, and it's just this little man there, and they said, you know, who are you to tell us, you know, the British, that we should leave, you know, India? You know, what power do you have? You don't have an army, you don't have tanks and weaponry and all that stuff. And he said, I have an idea whose time has come. And I think that that's what we have now. We have an idea whose time has come, which is that corporate rule throughout the world has to stop. And it has to be put back in the hands of people. And the needs of the environment are important, or we're not going to have a world to live in anymore. The needs of people's employment level are important. Or we're gonna have, you know, just mass starvation, you know, and there has to be some way of putting the corporate powers in check. And that movement, you know, we saw it touch down in Seattle last year, but that was just part of a movement that's been going on for the last century around the world in terms of indigenous people fighting back against colonialism. That's really what it comes down to.
Michael, I know you spent a lot of time with us and you're hungry.
Yeah.
Any final thing you want to say?
Yeah, I'd just like to say I'm very grateful to the people of Northern California for coming out, you know, and supporting my music for a long time. And, you know, my music is just beginning to get heard by new groups of people now. And it's funny, I feel like I'm just starting my career now, but I've already been doing it for 13 years. And so I'm grateful for people who have supported it along the way. And the other thing I'd like to say is that we have a website, which is spearheadvibrations.com. And it's become a great place for people to go to write poetry, to share ideas about the world and through the message board, talk about music, talk about their lives, and then, you know, talk about getting a ride to the next Spearhead show, whatever you want. And it's been a cool place for people to commune. So I invite anybody listening to check out spearheadvibrations.com.
Thanks.
Our guest has been Michael Franti of Spearhead. Thanks to Paul Emery, the Northern California Center for the Arts, and Diana Fox for making this interview possible. My name is Mike Thornton. This has been Full Logic Reverse.
Even though I'm stuck on you, each one should teach one and share with one another. So many is out there that's living undercover. Your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, your friends and their enemies all have their lovers.
The people in the middle, we got hot wax and it's cooking on the griddle. Got the guitars to rhyming, the drummer to rhyming, the people are humming and the vibes was loving. Hey, diddle diddle to the people in the middle, we got hot wax and it's cooking on the griddle. Got the guitars to rhyming, the drummer to rhyming, the people are humming and the vibes was loving.
Definition of a sellout. Cast your first stone, but then get the hell out. The people say they know me, I can tell you that they don't. The people say they own me, I can tell you that they won't. The left and the right, they all try to use me, but I'll be in the faces before they can abuse me. So roll down your window and listen what I'm saying. Relax your mind and let the band keep playing. To the people in the middle, we got hot wax and it's cooking on the griddle. Got the guitars to rhyming, the drummer to rhyming, the people are humming and the vibe was loving. But hey, diddle diddle to the people in the middle, we got hot wax and it's cooking on the griddle. Got the guitars to rhyming, the drummer to rhyming, the people are humming and the vibe was loving.
To the right direction, on and on, 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 and on,
as spearheads comes alive on the eve of 2000. 1145, no job, we be survivors singing praises to God every time we throw that and every time we puff live. You can move my way on the chop, super high. We'll never be back through. Yo, wait, no way. When I go, I like that. Because we living for the rhythm and the funk is always fat. So we bring fat beats like a gift for Christmas. I make you testify just like an O.J. Simpson witness. I sounded so alarming, like killer bees, people are be swarming. So like the price is right, come on down, make a little wish. But excuse me while I light my spliff and make some noise if you think the herb's a gift, y'all.
Let me see how I'm going along.